Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows, but today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to The Boiling Frogs with Sibel Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins, and today it's just Sibel and me. We decided not to do an interview, but to have a conversation about some issues that are in play right now that we both feel very strongly about. Sibel, as always, good to be with you.
Hi, Peter, and great to be with you. This is going to be fun. Hard-hitting, but fun.
Let's start with a post that you put up this week, and we're speaking right now on the 15th of November. You went to a book and author event in your hometown of Bend, Oregon, earlier this week, and you had a very bad reaction to something that the author said. So why don't you set that up and explain it to our listeners?
Sure. I was invited to this book reading and signing event by the author's wife, very nice lady. I'm scheduled to give this small talk. They have a very large book club, all female here in Bend. So she invited me to attend. And the author, he is in his late 70s, early 80s. And this had to do with some of those people who faced severe retaliation during the McCarthy era. Mm-hmm. Okay, and this is around World War II. And so he was with the military and the State Department, and same thing with his father. And they were targeted, and there were some really nasty things that, you know, took place. And it's very, very interesting case. I think it's a very interesting book. The topic, you can see all the parallels with what's happening today. Anyhow, after this long book reading session, the audience there, they started posing questions. And one guy there, he raised his hand and he said, "Well, with all your experiences, et cetera, how do you view what we are seeing today with all the whistleblowers? You know, we have Snowden and we have Manning." And this guy said, you know, the times are really, really hard, really bad, so much wrongdoings taking place, you know, all those things that he talked about. So, and then we get whistleblowers. I do not disagree with what they are opposing or what they are blowing the whistle on. However, I do oppose the vehicle they are utilizing to do it by coming out public or leaking information to the media or putting out documents, you know, organizations such as WikiLeaks, etc. That is very wrong. It is very damaging. It is not constructive. And you will never, ever bring about any change. You will never have a chance to do something that would bring about any change if you blow the whistle, come out and do all this opposing publicly, meaning going public.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way people who witness and see wrongdoing can address it or at least have a chance to correct it or help correct it, it may take a while to do it, is to do it inside, you know, from within the system, whether it's the CIA or the State Department or the Defense Department or the FBI. These people, you see wrongdoing, you just stay inside and be patient and work with the system and help get it corrected.
Oh, now, wow.
Here I am, a whistleblower. And so forget about my experience. Maybe mine
well,
is
no,
like
I can't.
Please. Mine is just like way too severe. Of course, there are much more severe cases that have come out, especially recently. But I'm thinking of over 200 national security whistleblowers that we have as our members in our organization, National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. I have read all their cases. I have met with these people. I have gone through their court cases, etc. And we have, you know, DIA, and we have the State Department and the FBI, etc. I've never come across a single case where I could say, you know what, this person actually could have done some good stuff from inside, and he or she would have had a better chance to do something inside. He or she would never have a chance, not even 0.001%. First of all, they won't let you really remain inside. You're going to get one way or another fired. You know, they're going to pull your security clearance so you can't do your job. I mean, we see, first of all, what this guy is talking about is he's saying something that is under this assumption that that's the first channel these whistleblowers go to, that they don't first try to do something inside, that they do not bring this stuff up with their supervisors, that the first step they take, they see some wrongdoing, they just run out, you know, they're out in the street, they go to the reporters, call these reporters and say, here it is, here are the documents, top secret, classified. First of all, usually, almost always, the public, the going public is the last resort. And that's very naive. More and more whistleblowers have realized this thanks to our experiences collectively. So they know that it is really dumb. It's futile. All you do is you face more retaliation and you can get preempted by having a gag order slapped on you before you even blow the whistle. You get kicked out. So you may as well just skip those steps, you know, going to Congress, going to the Inspector General's office, all those steps, all those ridiculous steps, and make it public. Because if it's something that the public has the right to know, it is something criminal, fraud, waste, there's even an executive order that says the executive branch cannot use classification in order to prevent public's knowledge on issues that relate to criminal conduct by the government, severe waste, fraud, and abuse. So you can't even play, this is an executive order, you can't even play that card of classification and say, well, no, that's true what you're saying, but you can't talk about it. Public can't know about it because it's classified. You can't use that. Anyhow, I really didn't want to talk. I was among the audience. I listened to it. It was very interesting because this person, he's Jewish, and one of, you know, his family came here. They were Holocaust survivors. And there were several groups, you know, organizations within the Jewish community. They were there. Like one of them is called the Jewish Society Supporting Jewish American Authors. Like they were there and they were the one who actually organized this talk. They came all the way from Eugene and Portland because they have this network that they support each other, which is, you know, nice fuzzy warm thing. That's fine. But I would have liked to ask this gentleman and say, you know, what if people would have said the same thing with regimes and governments or the people, like, I don't know, like Hitler? You know, people should have, you know, worked within the system with Hitler, try to take away some of those wrongdoings. Can you imagine that? I mean, you talk with these people and say, well, would you should that be the case when we are facing those types of regimes? Let's say in this case, you're talking about Hitler.
Yeah. And using that example, Dr. Mengele was working inside, just looking for that opportunity to shut down a death camp and end the human medical experiments that he was ordered to conduct. I mean, that's just so bogus. We know that human nature and human history don't support the notion that you should stay inside a corrupt system and try to correct the corruption from within.
Exactly. And these were the people who were screaming and saying, where is the world? You need to step in. How do we get rid of a system like this? With extreme situations and extreme systems, extreme criminal, you know, systems, you need to have extreme measures. I mean, that is no-brainer. And so when you're looking at the situation on the ground here, when you're looking at everyday we as a nation causing all these deaths around the world, you know, frying people with our drones, happening every single day. It's almost on hourly basis. When you're looking around and seeing these whistleblowers that are being haunted and they're being jailed and persecuted and prosecuted, you know, and the fact that, you know, you're constantly 24/7 under surveillance, I mean, you put all these situations next to each other together out there and then say, yeah, well, let's take the time. You know, we can stay in the system. Maybe 15, 20 years from now, we can tweak a little footnote in some law or some process within the FBI. You can't do that. Yet, you know, after this guy answered the question this way, I mean, people nodded. We had about at least 100, 150 people there. So that was pretty amazing. And I would say almost all would be considered kind of liberal. You know, these are not, you know, some really, really conservative people saying everything, you know, classification and secrecy. But they all nodded and they kind of expressed their agreement that that's true. That, I have to play the devil's advocate here, because when we look at all these whistleblowers, including myself, including, you know, Manning and all these people, I mean, you look at the outcome, the results, at least so far, mine has been what, Peter? It's been 12 years. Mm-hmm. And we say, wow, did we really bring about any changes? So staying within the system
let me answer that question. The painful truth is that your experiences informed particularly the actions of Ed Snowden. And not you singularly, but your experience collectively with the others who preceded him in blowing the whistle, including those at the NSA. And so he, while I do consider Ed Snowden to be imperfect as a fugitive, and he should have planned his post-leak actions a little bit better so he didn't end up trapped in Russia, in terms of leaking and having his desired effect of forcing a discussion or a debate on these important constitutional matters, I do think that your experience helped inform his decisions and that he became a much more successful whistleblower because of your painful experiences.
That's true. Sometimes it works that way. Sometimes it has the opposite effect, meaning when other people with information, they see what takes place and what happens with people like Snowden, people like Manning, or like me, myself, then they say, look, I mean, nothing really comes out of it. Going out there blowing the whistle is not going to change anything either. So you start facing this dilemma. You don't, staying inside definitely is not an option. Just take that off.
Mm-hmm.
Going outside and doing this, well, that's when it becomes something between you, the whistleblower, and the public. So you say, I do it for the people's right to know. And people get to know about this. They get to hear about this. Then the question becomes, what then people do with that information? They say, oh, that's terrible. And a lot of these people are saying, yeah, but these are extreme situations and times because 9/11 took place and there are all these Al-Qaeda people out there. They're going to just kill us all. And this is state of emergency. What is it? I don't even know what color system we are on right now. Yellow, orange, purple, where? What is it? So that's some dismiss it that way and say, yeah, it's terrible. Some, just like my professors for public policy, my master's degree, they said, oh, we have this pendulum and it swings this way. You know, we had McCarthyism and then it swinged the other way, but really did it. Hmm. And that's the question. And that's what people want to believe. And that's why I was giving that example with the current conversation about these bills that they are talking about. Nobody really is talking about how atrocious the whole reality of it is, the NSA and what it's doing and its implication. Now they are saying, let's make it a little bit, tiny bit better by have some mechanism to oversee. First of all, let's say you even had a mechanism that worked, right? That oversaw these activities. Let's say you have it. who is going to hold them accountable when they are breaking the laws then? You may oversee it, but that doesn't mean you have any power to stop them. Or to actually, you have the power, but that doesn't mean you're going to use that power, you being the Congress, mm-hmm. to prosecute them, to impeach them, to fire them, to jail them. As long as that is the reality, and that is you have a Congress that is not willing under any circumstances to exercise its power.
Yeah.
Under well, any circumstances. And we had it with Bush.
Well, and we have this pattern of this rationalized concept of self-enforcement. And, you know, we had Milton Friedman and Alan Greenspan telling us that Wall Street would police itself and that market would correct any excesses. Well, we've seen the evidence of that. And then we have this kind of trust us approach where we are feared up by 9/11 and other alleged events of domestic terrorism, and we're supposed to immediately surrender our rights, whether it's at the airport or in front of our computer or on our telephones. And this is where the boiling frogs analogy is so powerful, Sibel, that we have a group of people who are so complacent and who are, victims of misplaced trust, at least in one respect, and they are content to believe when Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Intelligence Committee, says that Ed Snowden deserves to be tried and locked up for years because he didn't come to her committee or the House Intelligence Committee with his disclosures. Well, you know, the best example of that is Mark Klein, the original... Well, but let me stay with Klein because... Mark Klein was the AT&T whistleblower who observed the installation of the NSA diversion switch at AT&T's facilities in San Francisco, and he went to Senator Feinstein with that information and said, isn't this illegal? Isn't this unconstitutional? Well, she turned around and reported him to the NSA. So that is the very first example I know of somebody who took the advice that is still proffered by Senator Feinstein with a straight face. And the history is replete with people who didn't consider themselves whistleblowers. They observed wrongdoing. They went through the channels to report it. And then they became the victims of massive reprisal efforts. And this pattern has been repeated over and over, and it's only people who are ignorant or willfully oblivious who can't see that pattern.
Sure, and as you know, the mainstream media is playing a magnificent role in this. They never put it under these clear terms that you just put forth. They pose the question about Snowden, maybe, did he try doing this? Why didn't he do it? The mainstream media usually doesn't put those together. So, you know, they put the information out there, but they don't package it this way by saying, yes, but look, before Snowden, this is what happened to Mark Klein, who tried to do it the supposed systems way initially. Or before Klein, there was Russell Tice, NSA. If they were to put his case and what's happening together with these cases. Now, some of the alternative media people are doing a great job with it. People like, let's say, Kevin Gostola. But when you're looking at New York Times, Washington Post, etc., you don't see it being packaged that way intentionally by design. So it leaves the reader with either this more ignorance or it is the misunderstanding that, hey, this guy saw some wrongdoing, took out all these classified documents and went out and dumped it. And you brought up another very important issue about how, you know, in this, we haven't seen any accountability either through Congress or the so-called ridiculously called the justice system. You know, with all the scandals and all the criminal deeds by the big banks, you know, whether it's JP Morgan, nothing. We haven't seen any of these ginormous, big, massive criminals touched. And yet you're seeing these cases every day, like the report that was released by the ACLU and saying currently there are over 3,000 people serving life sentences for nonviolent crime and mm-hmm. with no chance of having parole. This is so like having our entire nation as the stage, as the set for for Victor Hugo's Les Miserables.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting these people with petty crime, okay? So he had a little bit of marijuana the second or third time, so the guy got three strikes. Or you get, you know, some hacktivist who is trying, that's his way to go and hack the government. The government is hacking us every day, every second. But they're saying you can't hack us.
Right.
Hacking is good if it goes, you know, towards one direction.
And this, the same is true of leaks. We have daily cascades of official leakers who are not held accountable for anything. And then when principled leakers expose wrongdoing, corruption, corporate welfare and fraud and graft and corruption, they're the problem and they've got to be silenced.
Absolutely. And that is basically what we are talking about here. We are not talking about any kind of republic and all those illusions, etc. We are talking about dictatorship. So it is not inflicted by a king. And we have this government that is acting as king, worse than any other emperors, really, that I can think of. That's what we have in place. And yet we have this title, shiny, like a joke title that goes with it, is a democracy, the United States of America, and the representative system. Well, again, another survey came out yesterday, and the poll results said less than 9% of people in the United States trust the Congress. Okay, and I keep doing this math. Okay, so fine, half of the people don't vote. We still have 50% of the people voting, right? So they go and vote, and yet 9% trust those people they voted in. So there's something wrong with this map because every 2 years, the same people go and cast their vote, then come back and they say these people are charlatans. They're true. You know, they're crooks. True. And they say they don't trust them. Now, what's wrong here, Peter?
Well, we have a real lack of will on the part of Americans because the information is available. All right, whether it's through Boiling Frogs Post or other outlets, there's a lot of information available about the extent of the things that we're talking about. But people choose to say, oh, I'm too busy, and gosh, you know, I'm really worried about who's going to win American Idol or what's up with the Kardashians. And so there is this deep narcotic that is fed to the American people through television and other media distractions that keep people distracted and in some ways just divided and unable to reach consensus about the extent of these problems and who is ultimately responsible. Also, the narcotic is spread that you too could be the next pick your billionaire, Larry Ellison or the kid who runs Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg. And so there are plenty of people who are willing to suspend their own self-interest because they think that they might get lucky and be the next billionaire. And so they don't want taxes raised on other billionaires because they might be one someday. And this kind of projection and displacement is working on a magnificent scale. If you happen to be one of the one percenters who wants to see the rest of the people fighting over scraps and, most importantly, fighting each other.
Absolutely. It's true. But let's admit it. We are all paying taxes. And yet we still see, let's say with some of the more progressives, and we see this deniability of responsibility, saying, well, I'm not supporting the system. You know, I oppose it. You know, I'm totally against this idea of drones. But are you doing anything about it? Sure, I sign a petition. I mean, I haven't signed a petition, and I've been saying no to petitions since 2008. I went down that road for several years. Oh, yeah, let's collect 150,000 signatures, present it to Congress, and have something happen. Well, that doesn't work that way. You know, we can maybe collect tens of millions of dollars and go to one of these big lobby firms and say, now you represent us. You know, that's how we can get representation. Americans, you know, you have to give the tens of millions of dollars through lobbyists, channel it to these representatives that you elected, so maybe they can do something about it. So that, and the fact that, yes, we are paying taxes, And we are not even taking it personally when we are presented with all these developments, with data like, you know, you read the headlines with the CIA. CIA paid AT&T $10 million. They bribed AT&T by giving them $10 million for more information for them to do a better job with their spying, basically, okay? So that was the headlines. It came out even through the mainstream media. A lot of people, they don't see this $10 million as something that they have given, we the people have given, the government and the CIA. They think of it as CIA gave us money, its own money, went in there and gave $10 million bribery to this telecom. There is this detachment between the taxpayers, between the people, and the money they're giving to the government, okay? There is this big detachment because they don't attach all the screwing ups that are happening. I mean, we are actually paying the government to turn around and screw us. It's as simple as that. NSA is spending billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars a year. Mm-hmm. Well, we are paying NSA to turn around and spy on us. I mean, that is actually terrifying. And in a way, it's ludicrous because we are getting paid to get screwed this way.
Well, and in all the talk about our deficit and the long-term debt, we never put intelligence up for cuts. We never put defense up for cuts.
No way.
And it's very telling because this week, the new director of the FBI, James Comey, was up on Capitol Hill, and it was very interesting what he said. And that is that terrorist attacks like 9/11 are receding in the level of risk. And he claimed that the biggest risk now is cyber warfare. So this calculation, if you use my interpretation, is that we could dismantle many elements of the police state that has been expanded and erected since 9/11. But that isn't even contemplated, and I haven't heard any commentators who heard Comey's remarks suggest that. Instead, he's able to pivot from Osama bin Laden as the boogeyman to cyber warfare as the boogeyman. And we're all supposed to be quivering here and saying, please tap my phone, read my email, access my web accounts, because we need to be protected from cyber warfare. But nobody mentions that we are the world's biggest aggressor in cyber warfare. We act as if we are simply victims of repeated attacks from China or Iran or elsewhere, when we know that we are very active. And we just learned this week that the Stuxnet virus that we introduced to the Iran nuclear sector also has shown up in Russia. And yet Comey was up on the Hill and wasn't challenged either by a member of Congress or by the media on his assertion that, you know, our biggest threat is cyber.
No, true. I mean, we always go out and sing this WMD song. And look at, let's think about this. Let's name the nation with this huge, thick record file on using WMD. I mean, seriously, who has really gone out and used the nuclear weapons? Mm-hmm. Of all the powers in the world, okay, including back then the Soviet Union. Duh. Who has been using Agent Orange all over Vietnam? Every time I go to Vietnam, I go and visit. Now they are into the third, fourth generations. And you see how they are still suffering the results. We have been the world's greatest criminal as far as the WMD and the nuclear weapons within the WMD scenario goes. And that's exactly the hypocrisy. That's what we are playing with that. Same thing as you just mentioned with the cyber warfare. And who is being the threat to the world and all the other nations? And that's us. And by the way, there's something that maybe you're not as up to date, Peter. You said it went from Al-Qaeda to cyber warfare, the threat. There's actually another one. There's another threat they just cited, and it came out through BBC. Currently, they are considering conspiracy theorists the biggest threat to democracy.
Right. Yeah.
And our safety and security. I don't know. It may even exceed the cyber warfare threat when it comes to what they are perceiving. Bloggers and the radio hosts such as yourself, Peter.
Oh, yeah. I'm part of that threat. There's no doubt about it. Now, let's talk a little bit, because today, November 15th, Jeremy Hammond gave a statement at his sentencing, and he received a 10-year federal prison sentence for hacktivist activities, which he acknowledged in his statement. He does acknowledge that he broke the law, and he explained why he did it. And what I consider to be most important is that, consistent with virtually every other domestic terrorism prosecution, there was a paid FBI informant in his case. And some of the hacktivism that he did, some of the sites that he went into and grabbed email spools and files from, were directly suggested by his FBI informant. And in his statement to the court, he said that, I didn't know it at the time, but my FBI informant set up a server controlled by the FBI where I dumped all of the stuff that I hacked into and acquired. And as I've explained to you before, Trevor Aronson is an author who published a book earlier this year. He carefully examined over 500 individual cases of so-called domestic terror prosecution. And less than 1%, Sibel, were legitimate, untainted prosecutions of individuals where there wasn't an FBI informant or some other form of legal manipulation. And so let's talk about Jeremy Hammond, because I know you were extremely touched by his statement to the court.
Oh, this morning, that was one of the first things I ended up reading, because I'm 3 hours back, and by then everything was out on Hammond, and I read his statement, and it was very eloquent. It was very powerful. I consider it much more powerful than Bradley Manning's, because even though he pleaded guilty and he accepted responsibility for some of those minor outcome of his hacking, where maybe possibly the innocent people ended up getting affected, he really stood his ground so firmly. There were you didn't read any of this begging forgiveness or regret his actions, and he did an excellent job delivering this powerful statement. And and of course, he has a wonderful quote there from Frederick Douglass, and you would do it justice, not me, reading it, which has always been one of my most favorite quotes. And that's when I just started crying. It was extremely powerful. So if people haven't read his statement in full, please go and read it. And I'm going to publish it on my website at Boiling Frogs Post, so we can read and have people read the statement.
Well, let me actually, if you'll indulge me, I'd like to read two paragraphs that appear back to back in his statement. And one relates to what I was addressing just a moment ago. Quote, "The U.S. hypes the threat of hackers in order to justify the multi-billion-dollar cybersecurity industrial complex. But it is also responsible for the same conduct it aggressively prosecutes and claims to work to prevent. The hypocrisy of, quote, law and order and the injustices caused by capitalism cannot be cured by institutional reform, but through civil disobedience and direct action. Yes, says Jeremy Hammond, I broke the law. But I believe that sometimes laws must be broken in order to make room for change." And just before that, he says, "The government celebrates my conviction and imprisonment, hoping that it will close the door on the full story. I took responsibility for my actions by pleading guilty. But when will the government be made to answer for its crimes?" And then, in the immortal words of Frederick Douglass, "Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you have found out the exact measure of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them. And these will continue till they are resisted with either words or blows or both. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress." That is quite a statement from a young man.
Absolutely. And this was one of the points I was trying to make. I'm not articulate and eloquent like Hammond, but in my piece, that we do have to take responsibility for where we are today and for all these things that are happening. And as I mentioned, we are paying taxes. We are paying for these kings to act criminally, not only, you know, the stuff that they do here in the United States, but all over the world, and all the murders that we are therefore responsible for, and spy on us, and persecute and prosecute truth tellers. And now they are really carving another niche. They are testing the ground, the climate, for actually directly going after the reporters and escalating that. I mean, there's a lot of testing going on. Some people maybe won't agree with this, but I believe they have been testing it, and with little bits and pieces here, when they are doing some of these targetings, they're watching our reaction to see what kind of outcry they are going to get. And, you know, there hasn't been much if any, outcry on this. But as Hammond said, you know, you will not have these oppressors, these dictators, unless you have people who are willing to be oppressed, unless we have people who are going to let the oppressor oppress them. As simple as that. And you cannot take that part of the equation away. And again, a lot of people, they say, government is doing this to me, government is doing that to us. It's we are taking it. Unfortunately, the majority is still bent over and they are taking it. And the, as the boiling frogs analogy goes, and they keep raising the heat, they keep raising their criminal action, the intensity of it, the level of it, every single day. And the frogs, the majority, they're just sitting there. They're just sitting there and watch the water boil.
Sibel, I want to turn to an article that you published, I guess, about 3 weeks ago. And you provided a very important analysis of the coverage of a specific story by a specific outlet. And the outlet is Democracy Now! And many of our listeners look to Democracy Now! As the most independent, broad-based, and accessible media platform. They have a website, they broadcast on radio, and they stream their video now, too. And what you were able to show us through just careful research and connecting some dots is that the Democracy Now! Program receives money from interests related to billionaire George Soros. And in this particular story, they were interviewing people who also work for organizations that are funded by George Soros. And the end result was a carefully circumscribed story that left out very important details and very important players, because they might conflict with the interests of their patron. And along the way, one of the things that raised my crooked eyebrows was how much money Amy Goodman is making. She's paying herself $1 million a year from this nonprofit, independent news organization. So take a few minutes to talk about that, because I really think that it's important to look critically at the media that we do ingest each day. And it's real easy to see the corruption and the conflicts of interest, whether it's at Fox News or on the other end at MSNBC. But for many people, Democracy Now! Is a trusted voice.
No, absolutely. And I understand that. The reason I understand that is I used to view Democracy Now! That way too. And this is during the early stage of my case. You know, Amy Goodman's show, they interviewed me in 2003 and then in 2004 and then with David Rose's article in Vanity Fair, you know, because that had to do with Dennis Hastert, Speaker of the House, Republican, and the gag order was being imposed by John Ashcroft. That was George W. Bush's attorney general. The, you know, George W. Bush's FBI retaliating against me. So I was the whistleblower case, but I was it was limited by Democracy Now! As George W. Bush's whistleblower. But you have been paying attention to my case even long before I was on Amy Goodman's show, Peter. And as you know, in my interviews with you, and many other places, the real alternative channels, had always, from since day one, emphasized the time period these files covered. I said this covered what I know, what they are gagging, covered the time period 1997 till the end of 2001. Look, three of those 5 years were under Clinton. And there is as much, if not more, on Bill Clinton's administration and what we were doing, and this is we being the CIA and the Pentagon and NATO in Central Asia and Caucasus, how we were actually having joint operations with these so-called now called Al-Qaeda people, including Ayman Zawahiri in Azerbaijan. I said these stuff were taking place during Clinton administration, 3 years of it. And then, of course, we had George W. Bush, and then we had 9/11, and then we had this evil George W. Bush practices of the Patriot Act and all the stuff that started taking place and the retaliation against me. But I was never given a chance, for example, to pose that or even get there with Amy Goodman's show. At the time, this was during time I was kind of naive. Well, she would, or her producers, let's stick with George W. Bush right now. We don't have to get into the 1997-2000. Well, that right there is selective reporting. You are omitting the whole picture and you are censoring that from your audience. You're saying all this stuff and she's gagged and all this case is happening because of what George W. Bush wants to hide. And I wanted to, and as I did, and I had been doing in other outlets. But again, my antennas at the time, they were not as sensitive. I kind of got them really sensitive as the years went by. And so what happened was by 2008, the elections, Obama administration, and then suddenly that same show that had me over 3-4 times on these issues. You know, I had the case, for example, with the deposition of mine under oath where I was there. Mm-hmm. Amy Goodman told people, and this is including my attorneys, they would never have me on their show on this case because I have been very harsh. Harsh. That's the word Amy Goodman's producer used. Sabelle Edmonds had been very harsh on Obama. Huh. Harsh. Okay, not false, harsh. I have, because I started criticizing Obama with the same intensity I was criticizing the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. And mine started right away. It was within the first few months, you know, when he started giving immunities, you know, and talking about immunities for these. And this is exactly the opposite of what he was promising people. Anyhow, another interesting point that I want to make is during those years when I was taken, each time I was taken to her show, and back then I lived near D.C. in Alexandria, mm-hmm. so I would go to the studio to be interviewed. I was always given that time, you know, slot and taken there because of the organizations that worked with Amy Goodman. I mean, they were the ones who would determine who she interviewed, not Amy Goodman or her producer, and I'm trying to remember his name, Mike somebody there. For example, in my case, it was facilitated by this lady. She's a very nice lady as a person. I like her. Her name is Harriet Crosby, and I don't know if you met her while you were in D.C. Well, Harriet, together with George Soros, she has her own foundation. But it's not like George Soros. George Soros gives $500 million a year or whatever. Harriet Crosby gives $50 million a year to all these organizations. But they are part of this group of organizations, foundations. Harriet Crosby, Rockefeller Foundation, George Soros, Carnegie, Hewlett-Packard, and the Knight Foundation, okay? These groups basically funded all these channels that actually I kept coming to interact with. They funded the same circle, the group, the exact same people. They funded Project on Government Oversight. They funded Government Accountability Project, GAP. They funded MoveOn.org. They funded Amy Goodman. All those people, like Harriet Crosby, gives Amy Goodman about, I don't know, $150,000 or $200,000. Or during those years, that was how much she contributed. Mm-hmm. And now I'm naming names here. You know, I would ordinarily say a friend of mine. Let's just name the names because I'm standing by it. They can go and look at, you know, Harriet Crosby's record. As I said, I have nothing against the lady. However, the same circle determined which cases Project on Government Oversight took as far as whistleblowers went. Mm. They actually told Amy Goodman which whistleblowers to interview. And at the time, I was on their good side because Bush had gagged me, Ashcroft. I was a perfect prop to sit there, and it was truthful too. I didn't have to make up anything. I had all those gag orders, and to just pound that over and over and over and over again, how much of an evil this administration was, which was, I will disagree with that, definitely evil. They made my life hell. They made our lives hell as a nation, as much as, or maybe even less than Obama. You have to put it in this relative terms. 2008 came, and after that, they said under no circumstances they would have me. Before that, I had gone to 3 or 4 luncheons with Amy Goodman, Harriet Crosby. Do you know who would be present in those luncheons in D.C.?
Tell me.
At the time, the man who managed all George Soros's funding's distribution, okay? For example, George Soros says, I have $15 million or $150 million that has to be divided between these alternative medias, Amy Goodman, okay, millions of dollars to her organization, Pogo, Gap, etc. Well, the man who was in charge of distributing this and deciding who's going to get how much of this pie was Mort Halperin.
Mm.
Okay, Mort Halperin also happens to be going a long way back with Daniel Ellsberg, and Daniel Ellsberg also is good friend of mine. But Mort Halperin would be present sitting at top of these tables whenever there was a meeting on these whistleblower cases at Pogo, whenever there was meetings with Amy Goodman. So it was not hands-off that we give Amy Goodman $1.5 million salary, but it's just because we are so altruistic, we are good people, you know, we just like to help out because we are pro-public's right to know. You know, because he has a golden heart, George Soros. Isn't he known for that? You know, as far as I know, his record has been, he's been screwing nations and people. He has had brought lawsuits against people who've been trying to write books about him in Germany. You know, that's William Engdahl,
mm-hmm.
and trying to gag his book because it exposes his disgustingness, okay? And then there is other lawsuits against him on his actions against human rights-related stuff in France. I mean, you're looking at this guy and say, now tell me, why would George Soros, okay, this shady, dark billionaire whose entire intention is power and money, okay, would give millions of dollars to Amy Goodman if she's an alternative channel and if she is challenging the establishment? George Soros is the establishment, is the one person we've been fighting against. He is. Is anyone who can come and claim otherwise? I mean, I would say people would look at that person and say, you must be nuts. That's an established fact. So you say, why would George Soros give Amy Goodman $1.5 million a year? What is he getting? I'm not going to imply anything inappropriate. I think she's way past that stage that anybody wants to get anything else from her. But other than that, Peter, I mean, what is it? So this show comes on, and this episode totally deals with the time period, the region, the country, and a case that I was involved with the FBI, with these files, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This has to do with Azerbaijan in 1998 and 1999, okay? So Amy Goodman brings the guy who represents the attorney, who represents this guy who was in jail on corruption. He was trying supposedly to bribe the Aliyev regime for his deal. And then he brings, so that guy is funded, his research in the university, this law school university, the lawyer, is funded by George Soros. Then Amy Goodman brings Armstrong, and Armstrong has been for over a decade George Soros's little, you know, illegitimate son. You know, he's the sugar daddy to so many people. Well, he has been Armstrong's sugar daddy. You can go and look how much money, $250,000, his own organization gets paid, and this is Armstrong, in addition to other funds that go directly from several George Soros foundations. You know, one is Open Society. He has so many of these. He has created this maze. Because not all his foundations has George Soros foundations.
Mm-hmm.
They say Open Society, Media Freedom, et cetera, et cetera. So there is the guy, the attorney, who's being funded by George Soros. Then you have Armstrong, who's been funded by George Soros for over a decade. Then you have Amy Goodman, who gets paid $1.5 million by George Soros. And then you get Juan Gonzalez, whose salary comes because George Soros gives all these other millions of dollars to Amy Goodman's program. And they take this case And they give nothing but false information. First of all, they present what was happening on the ground in Azerbaijan when this guy's case took place, completely opposite of what the realities were on the ground. They're talking about these casinos. Everything is Russia connected. Russian fraudulent banks, the Russian mafia, the Russian oil industry, the Russian government, and the Russian casino owners. Guess what? The casinos were shut down by 1998, 1999. All the casinos in Azerbaijan, every single one of them, were owned by Turkish people. And I can, in fact, I wrote an article and I put links there. I put the names of individuals who owned every single casinos in Azerbaijan. At the time, 1998, 1999, the only people who were bribing, and they were blackmailing, bribing, all sorts of corruptionist, corrupt channels they were using to go through Aliyev's regime, were all Western. 90% of those Westerns was the United States. Okay, it was together with Turkey or directly doing it. And yet in this show, they have made everything to be the Russians doing those things. Then all the historical records, all the facts are, then you have to ask this question, why? Why would Amy Goodman gave over an hour to this show? I mean, this is kind of unusual. This is this case. Nobody has been even reporting, not because it's an alternative case, because it's a slam dunk crook case, okay? Mm-hmm. And I believe the attorney, the district attorney in New York, stepped on CIA's toes by going after this guy, seriously. This is why during this guy's trial, you had all these top CIA people going and saying, Judge, you can't bring these witnesses for the government because they are our informants. And also, if you go and see most of the stuff, the case is redacted because it involves a lot of CIA operations on the ground in Azerbaijan. That's all out there. And then you say, why would Amy Goodman put this show for 1 hour? Oh my God, what a show. I'm talking about fiction. I mean, it was resembling science fiction. And then bring all the Soros people. Then all you have to do is to go and dig on Soros' investment and see what Soros has been doing in Azerbaijan since 1995. You get millions of dollars, and this is public record. You just Google it, that Soros has been spending lately to fund the people who are opposing Aliyev, okay? Because he no longer wants Aliyev there. And what is this case saying, the one that Amy Goodman is presenting? How corrupt is Aliyev and how Russians are doing this stuff? And also, if you look at his investment portfolio, Soros, you will see how much a stake this guy has in Azerbaijan. Okay? And there goes her puppet, Amy Goodman, putting this thing that is so deprived of any journalistic integrity. It is so false, it is so twisted, and it's packaged together with so much propaganda in it. That is just amazing. I mean, to a level that she does it all the time, okay? And she does some semi-good pieces. But guess what? Peter, New York Times sometimes does some good pieces, mm-hmm. don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And another good example would be the damn serial killer Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy didn't just rape and kill. Ted Bundy sometimes did some good things. He was working for some humanitarian organization as a volunteer. And there were people who thought he was the sweetest man on the planet. Because when he wanted, he could be sweet. And sometimes he engaged in good deeds. Would that make Ted Bundy less of a serial killer? Okay? So the same thing is true with Amy Goodman. She has sugar daddies. She's been down on her knees and she's been serving her sugar daddies, the Rockefeller, the Soros, for decades, okay? And she's been serving their interests. Sometimes does she do some good shows? Of course she does. You know, she gave platform to me and I was thankful for it. It did give me a chance to expose this case at the gag order to over 300,000-400,000 people at a time. And that was nice. But does that take away the fact that she's not alternative? She's a controlled opposition. She's serving the same 1% that we have been fighting against. She has the same sugar daddies that have vested interests in all these drones and all this intelligence industrial complex and all this suffocation that we are seeing within the media. She's no different. than the other scumbags within the New York Times or the Fox News or CBS, she is given allowance, and that's given by the sugar daddies, to do a little bit more good, okay? Maybe she has less restriction, but also it is for the sake of appearance of legitimacy, okay? You get sometimes these escort hookers, okay, in New York that are dressed so beautifully, like in conservative, expensive business suits. They are not walking around with these cheap red stilettos, you know, and the plastic-looking skirt. So to say that, well, that makes those people less of prostitute, and I don't have anything against prostitute. I think the whole thing should be legalized, okay? This is not an insult on prostitutes. But what I'm saying is they are engaged in prostitution as much as the prostitutes on the 14th Street in Washington, D.C. who are wearing those plasticky, the stereotype prostitute clothing. In the end, they are both engaged in same profession. And that is what you have with Amy Goodman. She's as much of a hooker as is the New York Times or the Fox News, okay? She's just dressed differently. Her dress has a little bit more integrity. It has more class, you know? I will not deny that. But that does not make her less of a prostitute. As simple as that.
Well, and Sibel, recently I have been working almost every day to draw attention to and win the release of a journalist friend of mine, Roger Shuler, who is now more than 3 weeks imprisoned in Shelby County, Alabama. And through friends, I have communicated with the production staff and directly with Amy Goodman at Democracy Now! And I don't know what her decisions are, and, you know, every day when you put a news broadcast together, you can't cover every subject that you want. But after more than 3 weeks, I'm not aware of a single minute of coverage, even a reference to the fact that Roger Shuler is unlawfully being held and that this is a significant First Amendment case. And I want to expand that because it's not just Democracy Now! And I have sometimes cringed a little bit when you have talked about the pseudo-alternative media. But let me say that those words have been ringing in my head the last few weeks as time and time again, and I'm going to be polite enough not to name names, but people who know Roger Shuler, who know his work, who operate in much the same manner as independent journalists using a blog, have chosen not to speak up for Roger, have sat on their hands and left their keyboards idle, rather than stick their necks out and advocate for his First Amendment rights. And I have found this to be not just disappointing, but it's really difficult to watch as someone who I consider to be a brother in this alternative media sphere is being left to languish in prison because there are people who are saying, well, there's nothing in it for me, and I can't benefit from putting myself out for this man who is being wrongfully jailed.
That's absolutely true, Peter. And see, because you now started having some firsthand experiences with it, but this is also the case with a lot of legitimate whistleblowers and institutions, the businesses, and they are business, okay? Businesses like Amy Goodman and some of the other so-called alternative media channels, how they pick and choose. I mean, that was an example. For example, if you're backed by one of those Soros and Rockefeller-funded whistleblowers organization, that's Project on Government Oversight, GAP, then it's a different story because they operate in circles. So that means your whistleblowing has to be accepted by the system. So that's, in a way, even if it's indirectly, system-approved whistleblowing. Number two, they trust, this is Amy Goodman, they trust these organizations, people like Danny O'Brien, to contain that whistleblower's interview. See, that's very important. They tried it with me. Now, don't go to 1997 business of yours. Let's just right now stick with John Ashcroft and the state secrets privilege. That's our focus. Let's not get into Clinton. So, because they're not that obvious, or maybe I was that dumb back then.
Well, so, and let me just add a more recent case. Russell Tice wanted to tell an MSNBC audience what he told us, and that is that he participated in wiretaps of top elected officials, including Senator Feinstein and then Senator Obama. And he was explicitly told by a producer in his earpiece that he should not talk about that, just as the interview was about to begin. So we have clear cases of people being told what they can and cannot say. And, of course, those ground rules and those restrictions are never explained to the viewer.
No. That's the thing. And when you have these, and I know, like, these are the Vietnam-era activists who got used to Amy Goodman back then. So I don't know how much of a sold-out whore she was back then, but maybe she was back then more idealistic. Maybe she was more, because sometimes it takes time to corrupt these people, you know? Sometimes, you know, or maybe people, some people, not you, definitely, some people, as they get older, as they age, they become a little bit more compromising, let me put it that way. Mm-hmm. So maybe back then she was an idealist, maybe she was real, but I think she gathered this core group of people who have refused to see her as the person she is today and see through some of the stuff, or even when they see through it, they become more forgiving. But here's the positive side, and this is one of the things you and I talked about. The positive thing is, well, back then, you know, we didn't have as much of these podcast shows that now people can produce and the video shows that people like Corbett is producing. So now she's more challenged, or institutions like hers, they're more challenged because they had more of a monopoly. You know, well, of course, they don't really rely on people's money. They're relying on their sugar daddy's money. So the money is going to pour in no matter what. But at some point, those sugar daddies going to say, well, some other people are kind of rising to the top on their own independently. They're collecting more and more audience. And therefore, maybe, I mean, this particular institution through Democracy Now or something else is not worth that much to me. Because they're going to start losing their values, too. They will have value as long as, like the mainstream media did once upon a time, you know, how much could we have really exposed before the internet with the New York Times? How much? I mean, the level that we have right now and the opportunity, the window that how much we can go out there and contradict. Granted, not that we are bringing about any changes, but at least to put the information out there. And you mentioned it, which is very, very important. You said, for anybody who wants to know, the information is out there. Why? Well, because we do have the internet. We do have your show. We do have these other very good, solid, real, independent channels. That is threatening. And I believe, again, that BBC article with the conspiracy theorists and them being the threat to democracy has a lot to do with the system's fear. The establishment is being very nervous, Peter. For BBC to bring in these three clown professors, and they are granted whatever $1 million or £1 million in England, Cambridge University, to put together this study, this scientific study of conspiracy theorists and how they endanger democracy, and therefore they are a threat to society, that's great because it tells us that we are making them really nervous. Look, if you were like those little mosquitoes and flies said, bah, they're the conspiracy theorists, they can go and talk about this and that, who cares? That would have been a different story. But now they are saying conspiracy theorists, they are challenging the government, therefore they are a threat to democracy. They are equating governments with democracy. I mean, that, I guess, includes Azerbaijan's Aliyev and Hitler. Hitler was some sort of a government as well.
So he was elected.
Yeah, there you go. Democratically, we can have democratically elected dictatorships. So that's the good part of it. And I believe we are in much better position today to challenge these phony, contained, controlled front alternatives, and of course the mainstream media, which has been a dying breed. Washington Post is down. I'm waiting when his New York Times turn is coming. We are challenging it. So that's a good part of it. That's a good news aspect of this whole grim thing. And you know, I want to tell people, I don't have anything against people like Amy Goodman or whatever, head of Pogo. They are just puppets, okay? Puppets. So it's not a personal thing, like personally attacking anything, you know, or anybody saying, oh, I have a beef with this person. I don't. I mean, I haven't met Soros. I met his bulldog, that Morton Halperin guy. And guess what? He's gone. He retired. You know that, right, Peter?
I didn't.
Mort Halperin retired around 2007, 2008 due to some health reason. And do you know who became the took his position? Who is the most important person that decides how much money goes to which one of these circle of, you know, organizations?
I don't.
The lady who represented me from the ACLU, my case, my state secrets privilege case, Ann Beeson.
Oh, really?
Ann Beeson of ACLU left ACLU around 2007, 2008, and now she's the woman who decides how much Amy Goodman can have as an increase, how much shrinkage will happen to Gap, because maybe they have Jessel and Radek now. They are not as popular. Jess Radek is very good.
Yes, she is.
So, and I think they don't want to have her as a whistleblower. I think they're in this really tight situation. They put her in there as an attorney. She took Thomas Drake's case and helped out with the case. And it would be horrifying for a whistleblower organization to create a whistleblower by kicking her out. But I don't think they are happy because Jessalyn Radek is real, but the organization itself is not. So, ACLU's Ann Beeson, the lady who represented my state secrets privilege case, decides how much raise every year or every other year Amy Goodman is going to get.
Now, let's tell our listeners that some changes are afoot at BoilingFrogsPost.com. And over the last year, you have attracted a lot of new and very smart contributors. You're doing a graphic facelift on the site. Tell us a little more.
Sure. I mean, with our partners, you and I have been together in this since I had that dingy little blogspot.com site and Paul Jamuel. But I mean, it's out there. I'm their biggest fans, my partners. I never stalked anybody before. Now I'm stalking them. I'm stalking them on the Twitter. I'm stalking you. It's like I'm getting to work with people that I truly admire, and that's the best part of it. And it's been going really, really good. Our website is changing. It's been under new design since August. And right now we are doing some of these, what do they call it, like debugging and testing to see if everything is functioning right. So we're going to switch over next week with a brand new design, and it's a real facelift, really. It's going to look and function much, much better in every term. And we did a lot of stuff about speed. Now we have a very good, fast, high-speed, dedicated server. And so we have been putting all those stuff together. We have increased our programs. And currently, you and I and James Corbett, we are discussing additional ideas, maybe more video shows, more interactive shows, more debates that are more passionate, exciting. And when I say passionate, exciting, I don't mean oh my God, we are doing it for the sake of being theatrical, because I hate those things. They get to be so phony and they turn me off. And I can see through those people. Those people, you know, whether it's Rush Limbaugh or whoever, they just do the hoo-ha-ha and this theatrical thing. They have high number of people who like them, but it's not our style. I'm talking about sticking with the same kind of heavy, hard-hitting topics, but have kind of maybe bolder, take the gloves off. Because I was saying, during the interviews, when we are interviewing you and I, other people, I'm the co-host, so I try to contain myself a lot because I am there to politely, respectfully, articulately, you know, and you do most of the work, of course, to present our guests, their views, however differing those views may be from ours, their perspective, you know, their legal expertise. So even though sometimes I find things that makes me want to jump and scream and say, oh my God, I can't believe this person said that. I'm biting my tongue. And I'm like, no. This is not about you, Sabelle. This is supposed to be about your guests. So I want to have some kind of a show together with you. This is maybe a warm-up video show that we can just talk the talk and walk the walk and do it both and be bold about it. And I don't have to worry about offending anyone or maybe sounding too harsh or ridiculous. And hopefully I'm kind of balanced by you and James Corbett, because you're both so eloquent and so measured and elegant and all those stuff. So then I get to be me. And you two will balance me. And that, I think that would be a great dynamic. I've been thinking about this for months. So as soon as this website is launched next week, We're going to do some test shows, you and I and Corbett, and then maybe you and I doing more video shows like this because it's fun. And I get to go yak, yak, yak and talk. I don't have forums to talk like that often. Here in Bend especially, seriously, everybody's talking about diets and exercise. I love the place. It's, and as you know, I'm always gushing about how magnificent it is. People are so nice and warm and smiley. And I just love the people, everything. But for some reason, everywhere I'm going, it's like all about diets and exercise and diets and exercise. And they're all from your area, Bay Area.
Yeah.
And I see this trend. There is this trend that people, they get like so into this diet and exercise thing. It's kind of unusual because, you know, I'm totally for healthy diets. I'm totally for exercising moderately, regularly. These are all my mottos and I practice it. I'm not being a hypocrite, but so much of it here. It's like the whole life becomes about measuring calories every single second. And that for me is really strange. And I don't have much to contribute in those conversations. That's why you get me talking here.
Well, anyhow, that's because, and I don't like to get too personal, but you have a fabulous figure, and I've never seen you gain weight, so I don't know that you have to count. I don't know you have to count calories and fight that. But Sabelle, I want to close with an appeal to our listeners. Because we've just spent time here explaining how other so-called alternative media outlets are captive to or catering to their patrons. And the patrons of my podcast at peterbcollins.com and your work at boilingfrogspost.com are the people who are listening right now. And I don't like to use guilt and I don't like to put pressure on people, but I think we need to explain that we're trying to make a living and trying to bring people the information and the commentary that they deserve. And we do it without advertisers. We do it without foundation support. And that means we have to turn to our listeners and our readers and say, how much is this worth to you? And are you willing to support it? Now, I don't want people's social security checks, and I don't want them robbing the piggy bank to support our work. But there are plenty of people who have a good job, have a good income, and can afford to peel off 5 or 10 or 20 bucks a month to support independent media outlets like ours. And unfortunately, we have to keep reminding people because they're used to free content and the advertiser-supported model that is self-corrupting, and we're trying to break away from that, and we need the support, the direct support of the people who use our products, our information.
Absolutely, Peter, and that's the only way to do it. I have been resisting, and first of all, foundation, forget it, because I will shut down this whole thing. We will go away. There won't be any Boiling Frogs Post, period. I wouldn't even consider something like foundations. I have only had one daddy. My father was just one person. I'm not into sugar daddy business. That's not going to happen. I believe in integrity. As far as advertisements, same thing. We even talked about it. My God, can you imagine? We're talking about military-industrial complex and all the horrific stuff that is happening, and then we have an advertisement being stuck there by Boeing or Northrop Grumman. That would be ridiculous. So the only way to do it is this. And I get people saying, oh my God, now even your news is for subscribers only. You took that away. Well, because we are supported by subscribers and donations. And every quarters we have this fundraising that makes us offer more of those services for free because we can afford it, because we can afford producing it and we can afford opening it to all. I just got several emails from people saying, shame on you. You had this great things on Kennedy and you're not opening it to all. Well, the whole thing is we won't be producing anything if we don't have people's support. Because if James Corbett has to go and work full-time back to his work again and work as a teacher, he's not going to produce a single video because he has a family, he has children, he has his job, and he's not going to have the time. Maybe on weekends he can produce a couple of podcasts for maybe for his website, but it's not going to happen. If Peter B. Collins is going to go and have juggle two jobs or be busy doing that because we have to have our food and shelter and our primary needs taken care of. I have a daughter. I don't, you know, I'm paying for my healthcare insurance, okay? So all this stuff are there. So it's not a matter of give it free or give it five. It's a matter of give it subscribe or free. It's a matter of will we be able to produce this or not? Meaning, will people support us? Will you support us and say, okay, this is the very good publicly subsidized news channel that brings us video reports, podcasts, aggregated news, editorial cartoons, op-eds, okay? And it's totally independent, but it's publicly subsidized. If that's the model and if you are helping it and we are publicly subsidized, then we are going to continue this. And not only that, we are going to expand because my big goal is, you know, we have been expanding these programs, but I want to have our own investigative journalists. I want to have to start with 2-3 great, solid, experienced reporters. None of those mainstream media leftovers. I'm not going to care for those people leftovers. You know, New York Times guy just retired after 30 years being in an establishment. I'm sorry. If something happens, I think we have to have those hazard suits that they put, you know, to even get close to those people so we won't get infected. So we won't do that. But we do need some good investigative reporters, and we want to start putting our own investigative piece. So please support us because we have been doing okay. We've been doing good, but we can do so much better, and that can only happen if you support us and if you're with us because this is all for all of us, for you and for us.
Sabelle Edmonds, always a pleasure. I'm Peter B. Collins. You've just heard another Boiling Frogs Post podcast.
Give me absolute control over every living soul, and that sanity, baby, that's an order. Take the only tree that's left, stuff it up the hole in your culture. Give me the back of a burning wall, give me a star and a thing all. I've seen the future, brother. It is murder.
Leo Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.